When three young South Dakotans survive a car crash, two of them walk away from the vehicle and aren't seen again for 3 months when their bodies are inexplicably discovered near the site of the crash. Question after question arises as investigators attempt to make sense of one of the most perplexing cases in South Dakota history in this episode of Last Seen Alive. Thanks for listening to Last Seen Alive. I'm your host, Leah, crime analyst by day and true crime storyteller by night.
And I'm your co-host, Scott.
Arnold Archambault and Ruby Bruyere were last seen alive on December 12, 1992. They were a young couple, 20 and 18 years old, respectively, and lived on the Yankton Sioux Reservation in rural Lake Andes, South Dakota. Both of them had grown up there, and they'd been high school sweethearts. Arnold had a job at a local casino owned by the tribe. Meanwhile, Ruby had her hands full with the baby girl she and Arnold had welcomed into the world the year before. Arnold and Ruby were young, and parenthood was demanding. With that being said, they managed to find time for fun, too. For example, on the night of December 12th, an uncle of Ruby's agreed to babysit the couple's daughter so they could go out. And actually, Ruby and Arnold didn't just leave their daughter in his care. They took his daughter, Ruby's cousin Tracy, with them when they left.
My first question is, was she much older than their daughter?
This wasn't a baby swap. Ruby's cousin didn't need babysitting. She was 17 years old, and she was a close friend of the couple.
Okay, so their age, and presumably saving her from babysitting.
Yes, and so the three of them climbed into Arnold's car and set off into the evening together. They returned at 6 a.m., and it was obvious to Ruby's uncle that they'd been drinking, so of course, he didn't wake up their daughter to send her home. Instead, he said, "You know what? I can babysit a while longer. Why don't you guys come back for her after you've sobered up?" Arnold and Ruby agreed, and they set out again into the cold morning in Arnold's car. Ruby decided to go with them. Arnold was driving, and between the fact that he'd been drinking and the winter road conditions, it's perhaps not surprising that he lost control of the vehicle and got into an accident. How that happened is no mystery. We know that the car hit a patch of black ice when they approached a three-way intersection. Fortunately, there were no other vehicles, so they didn't get into a collision with another car. That didn't mean they got off with just a scare and maybe a dented bumper, though. The vehicle actually flipped over onto its roof and stayed that way as it came to rest in a ditch. A quick note about the ditch, because it's so central to this story. When I say ditch, I don't mean a ditch that was intentionally dug or engineered. Rather, it was a depression that existed between the road and a nearby set of long unused railroad tracks. There was a large lake nearby, which meant the area was prone to flooding, so both the road and the railroad tracks had been built on raised earth to make them less susceptible to floodwaters. And the depression that was left between them as a byproduct of raising up the road and railway is what I'm referring to as the ditch.
So not like the small culvert we have running through our front yard.
No, not like that at all. Picture something much wider. Tracy recounted the crash to Unsolved Mysteries during an episode they filmed on this case, telling them the following, quote, "We came up to that stop sign. That's all I remember is just him looking, saying there are no cars, and him spinning out from the stop sign. And it was just like the snap of a finger, and the next thing you know, we ended up in the ditch. I was upside down in the ditch, and Ruby and I was in the car, you know. Arnold wasn't in the car. I don't know where he was. Ruby was crying. She was saying, oh my God, oh my God. She just kept hitting the car. The next thing I know, the door, it was open a little ways and she had enough room where she slid out. And then, so I was going to reach over and then it was just like that. The door went shut," end quote. So what happened was the car came to a stop in the ditch. Ruby and Tracy were inside, upside down, obviously. Ruby was freaking out. She managed to open the door and get out. Tracy went to open it too, but it was stuck.
Yeah, I wonder if it was like intentionally closed behind her.
Not that I know of, but notice that Tracy says that Arnold was already out of the car while she and Ruby were stuck inside. So it seems that either Arnold was ejected from the car during the crash, or maybe Tracy lost consciousness for a period of time. And by the time she regained it, Arnold had exited the upside down vehicle.
Yeah, my first instinct is, given the fact that alcohol is involved, I think it's safe to guess that they probably had pretty loose ideas of seatbelts, and there's a high probability of him being ejected.
Yeah, it certainly seems possible, but I'm not sure which is the case because none of the many sources I read or consulted specified. So I don't know if anybody knows.
The only time I've been unconscious was for like a surgery, and that time passed very quickly to me. So if she was rendered unconscious, I don't know if it would be the same and could contribute to the snap.
Yeah, usually when somebody comes out of a period of unconsciousness, they don't have much concept of how much time has passed. Either way, Ruby soon managed to exit the car as well, which left Tracy on her own. And Tracy actually watched Arnold and Ruby, two of her best friends, walk away from the scene without helping her out of the wrecked car or even saying anything to her. And at the time, she couldn't wrap her mind around why. Now, sitting here decades later, we had the luxuries of distance and hindsight and can speculate that Ruby and Arnold may have sustained head injuries during the crash and might not have been thinking clearly or acting normally. And of course, on top of any possible head injuries, they'd been drinking, which can also influence behavior.
One of my thoughts is, what if Tracy was unconscious and wasn't responding to any kind of stimulation and they thought they might have killed her?
Yes, like that's why she was saying, oh my God, and freaked out and wanted to get help. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but that makes a lot of sense. You know, so she came to at the tail end of maybe Ruby panicking and getting out of the car, but Ruby may not have noticed that she was conscious.
Yeah.
Maybe. So in any case, Tracy tried to extricate herself from the flipped vehicle as well, but she couldn't get the door open. It had fallen shut again behind Ruby and it wouldn't budge. So she was stuck until help came. Rescuers, including local law enforcement officers, arrived a little later that morning. Exactly how much later, none of the sources I've consulted say. But when they got there, Tracy was still trapped in the car and Arnold and Ruby hadn't returned to the scene of the wreck. And they hadn't been the ones to summon help for Tracy either. In fact, nobody knew where they were, which immediately gave investigators cause for worry, because patches of black ice like the one that had caused the wreck weren't the only danger ice posed in the immediate vicinity. The crash scene was very close to Lake Andes, which had frozen over. Investigators worried that if Ruby and Arnold had wandered onto its surface in a state of confusion or panic, they might have fallen through the ice, which would likely have proven deadly. So they searched along the lake's icy shore looking for any sign of cracked, caved in, or otherwise disturbed ice. They found none, which was a relief, and it made them think that perhaps the reason for Arnold and Ruby's conspicuous absence wasn't anything deadly after all. A local sheriff's deputy named Bill Youngstrom told Unsolved Mysteries the following, quote, "We walked around the ice part. We had one officer walk on the opposite side of the railroad tracks, thinking maybe they wandered off toward the lake area, which was also frozen. I've been to a number of accidents where there hasn't been somebody around. The driver hasn't been there, so no passengers there. And a lot of times it's because they've been partying, out drinking. I mean, we do have a DWI law. That was initially my first thought. Maybe Arnold was out drinking and didn't want to get arrested, so we figured he'd show up in a few days." End quote. And of course, we know from Ruby's uncle that Arnold and Ruby had been partying that night, so this seems like a pretty logical theory. But the thing is, neither Arnold nor Ruby showed up after a few days, or even a few weeks. Deputy Youngstrom was perplexed by their disappearances and became deeply invested in the case. The Unsolved Mysteries episode on this case describes his search for Ruby and Arnold as a personal crusade. Tracy was also perplexed by Ruby and Arnold's disappearance. With the help of rescuers, she'd been able to walk away from the car wreck without any grave injuries, but something else bothered her, the disappearances of Ruby and Arnold. Where could they possibly have gone? Or, more pointedly, why were they still gone? They'd left their baby daughter in the care of Tracy's dad and had never returned for her. It did not seem right. An aunt of Arnold's had been unsatisfied with law enforcement's initial theory that Arnold was simply dodging responsibility for a drunk driving accident and that the couple would turn back up soon. And her opinion holds a lot of weight because she knew Arnold well. He was living with her at the time of the disappearance, in fact. And that was normal. Arnold's mom had actually died when he'd been a child, so other women in the family served as maternal figures in his life. His grandmother had raised him, and as a young adult, he lived with his aunt. And his aunt told the Unsolved Mysteries crew this, quote, "I knew he wouldn't hide. He would have come home, or called us and told us, I'm over here, don't worry about me, but we never heard anything from him, end quote. According to a 1993 article for the Argus Leader newspaper, investigators noted that Ruby was still nursing her daughter, and they stated that it would be unusual for a mother to simply disappear, abandoning a nursing baby. So investigators extended their search efforts, combing the winter terrain near the site of the crash time and again, in case they'd missed something. Many of Ruby and Arnold's family members joined in too. But as weeks turned into months and winter began to give way to spring, Ruby and Arnold remained missing. Their families were left without answers and their young daughter without parents. And then, in March, approximately 3 months after they disappeared, someone driving through the same intersection that Arnold had wrecked at made a grim discovery, one that was seemingly impossible. More on that next. And now, back to Ruby and Arnold's story. In early March of 1993, about 3 months after Arnold and Ruby walked away from the scene of a car wreck and seemingly disappeared into thin air, a passing motorist saw a human body lying in a watery ditch near a three-way intersection. It was the same area where the car wreck had occurred 3 months prior, and when summoned to the area, law enforcement found a badly decomposed female body floating in approximately 4 feet of ice melt in the same ditch that Arnold had crashed his car in 2 months before. Her body was found approximately 75 feet away from where the crash had occurred. Although decomposition was too advanced for the victim's identity to be immediately apparent, investigators were ultimately able to identify the remains relatively quickly thanks to a tattoo that was still visible, and the body was Ruby's. Investigators weren't sure how her body had ended up floating in the ditch when they'd searched it so thoroughly months before, but they reasoned that if Ruby's remains were somehow there, maybe Arnold's were too, and so they drained the ditch, which resulted in them locating Arnold's remains the next day, just 15 feet from where they'd found Ruby's. Investigators noted that Arnold's body had undergone far less decomposition than Ruby's. In fact, they described his body as very well kept, which was odd.
Okay, so this has just made me think about the weather conditions and the decomposition. I mean, that time of the year is very cold, and it's in a pretty cold area anyways. So shouldn't that have helped preserve the bodies a little bit?
Well, compared to summer, certainly yes. But I actually looked up the historical temperature records, and it was routinely getting into the 30s and even high 40s during the day. So it wasn't that cold.
So it wasn't a constant state of freeze.
No, it wasn't. So one would think that if Arnold and Ruby had died at approximately the same time and had somehow been lying there together in the ditch the whole time, the whole 3 months, their bodies would be in similar stages of decomposition, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Arnold looked like Arnold, and Ruby had to be ID'd by a tattoo. It was a huge difference. Now, when I first read about how much more advanced the decomposition process was in Ruby's remains, I wondered if it was even possible that she and Arnold had died at remotely similar times. While trying to think of what could possibly have caused the difference if they had died at similar times, I did a little research into how body size affects the decomposition process, because I knew from photos that Ruby was a significantly smaller person than Arnold. I found a study published in the Journal of Forensic Science, which we've linked to on our website, that answered my exact question. The study was conducted using human bodies that had been donated to science, so the researchers actually had the chance to carefully observe and document the decomposition process in each of those bodies, which were of various sizes. And the end results? Quote, body mass likely has a minimal impact on postmortem interval estimation, end quote. Now, a postmortem interval means simply how much time has passed since the discovery of a body and the actual time of death. So the study found that a person's body mass shouldn't prevent investigators from estimating how long an individual has been deceased. It's the same. Large person, small person, in between, it's more or less the same.
Part of me wants to be really surprised by that, but the other part of me is saying that I would expect them to decompose the same, because ultimately it's the same base elements that make up everyone.
Right. I was trying to find something that might explain it. That was one of the best things I could come up with. And
it was a good thought.
I actually found another study to back it up in case the first one was wrong. And this was published in the International Forensic Science Journal that conducted a similar experiment, only they used the remains of pigs rather than of humans, and their results were pretty similar. They found that both the large and small bodies decayed rapidly in the early stages of decomposition. It wasn't until advanced stages of decomposition that a significant difference became apparent. Bodies of all sizes experienced a short plateau in the process at this point, but the larger bodies plateaued for notably longer than the smaller bodies. And this was in the late stages of decomposition. And of course, in the case of Arnold and Ruby, Arnold's body hadn't reached anything near an advanced stage of decomposition. Only Ruby's had. So, in conclusion, that was my best thought. And it was garbage. It seems that the difference in body size couldn't have accounted for the difference in the states of their bodies, decomposition-wise. And as for what did account for the difference? Well, that's one of several aspects of this case that remains baffling to this day. Law enforcement didn't believe that the bodies had been there the whole time. They publicly announced that shortly after the discovery of the bodies. Arnold and Ruby's families didn't believe their bodies had been there all along either. And remember, they desisted with the search. So the family and law enforcement were united in the belief that Ruby and Arnold had died somewhere else, somehow, and that someone had moved their bodies into the ditch after the fact.
So that has raised an interesting thought. Were they able to estimate a time of death?
Not that I know of. So Deputy Youngstrom, that deputy who was really into the case and who had been one of the first on the scene of the car wreck, told Unsolved Mysteries the following, quote, "It's impossible that they could have been there the entire 3 months. I myself personally walked that ditch several times during that period. I've gotten written affidavits from people that have also walked it, people that have nothing to do with the case. They couldn't have been there. They couldn't have been missed," end quote. And when investigators got the results of Ruby and Arnold's autopsies back, the medical examiner's findings did little to clear up their questions. Because the medical examiner believed that Arnold and Ruby had died of exposure, as in they'd frozen to death.
That was kind of where I was thinking, and I'm sure the investigators were when they went to go search the ice.
Only they didn't find them there, and apparently they died elsewhere and were moved there, which opens up a whole other array of possibilities.
I'm still not giving up on that quite yet, because it seems to be the most logical option at this point.
Yeah, and investigators didn't give up on it either. According to Unsolved Mysteries, Deputy Youngstrom believed that if the couple had frozen to death, it had happened elsewhere and someone had moved their bodies into the ditch for some reason.
How big was the lake?
Very large.
So is it possible that they could have gone further into the lake and missed where the ice had broken or given up?
And then their bodies somehow...
They followed the flow with the ice melt.
Honestly, I am not knowledgeable enough to tell you whether that's technically possible. I am not a lake expert, let alone a Lake Andes expert. But even if that did happen, once again, why were their bodies in such different stages of decomposition?
That's my only thing holding that back. And that's really the only drawback to my thought is the different states. But I mean, if I was searching and worried about people falling through the ice, I wouldn't really push my searchers further out onto an ice pack to check.
No, definitely not.
I could see it being missed if it was a large enough body of water. And if it was prone to flooding, I'm not sure which way the water flows out of Lake Andes, but if it followed that path, that could have moved the bodies. I'm sure this isn't a new theory that they haven't explored or they don't have a reason for it.
It's hard to say without being very familiar with the area yourself. And now, Deputy Youngstrom said what he said about the bodies being moved, not just because he and his peers had searched the ditch just hours after the accident and other times after that, but also because of something else that was found at the scene 3 months later when the bodies were discovered.
Holding out the secrets on me, I see.
Yes, that something was a tuft of hair found by the roadside. Ruby's hair. This is what Deputy Youngstrom told Unsolved Mysteries about it. Quote, "We found a tuft of hair alongside the road. This hair was later determined by the forensic laboratory to belong to Ruby Bruyere. That hair couldn't have stayed there for 3 months. In my opinion, it was when whoever brought the bodies back to the ditch, that's when that piece of hair fell off of Ruby. At the time we pulled Arnold's body from the ditch, I found a set of keys in his pocket. The keys were a car or vehicle key and what appeared to be two house keys. I still have these keys in my possession, and to this day, I have not found the vehicle nor the house that these keys fit. End quote.
Was this a more recent episode of Unsolved Mysteries?
No, it was one of the good old classics, the 1990s Robert Stacks. If you want to watch the episode yourself, we have the link on our website.
Okay, so that changes it a little bit. It's not like some detectives out there randomly with evidence, because I was wondering why he had that.
Okay, yes. It would be weird if 30 years later he said, I still have these keys in my possession. We know he said that, you know, not too long after the case occurred. And I assume that in his possession, he hopefully meant in police custody. But who's to say? So the keys are another enduring piece of this mystery that just doesn't seem to make much sense. Investigators eventually sent both bodies to a lab for a second autopsy opinion, and the professionals from that lab concluded that, yes, it was possible that Ruby and Arnold had both died of exposure, but it wasn't certain. Death by exposure was just one possible cause of death. Other causes couldn't be ruled out. There's something else I feel we'd be remiss not to mention about Arnold and Ruby's remains, and that's what they were wearing. Ruby was wearing the outfit she'd last been seen wearing on the day of her disappearance. Her shoes and glasses were missing, but her clothing was the same. Arnold, on the other hand, well, no one's sure whether the clothing he was found in was the clothing he'd disappeared in. For some reason, that's never been determined. Maybe no one remembered definitively what he'd been wearing that day. I don't know. But if Arnold's clothes weren't the same, and we don't know that they weren't, but if they weren't, that would seem to track with the fact that his body had undergone so much less decomposition than Ruby's. And either or both of these factors would raise the question, had Ruby died well before Arnold? It's one of many questions in this case that remains unanswered. During the course of their investigation into Ruby and Arnold's deaths, police were approached by several local witnesses who provided information relevant to the case. One of them was a guy who'd lost his hubcap along the highway around the same spot where the car crash had occurred. He'd later ridden his horse through the area and specifically through the ditch, including the spots where Arnold and Ruby's bodies were found a relatively short while later in search of his missing hubcap. So not only did people search that ditch for the actual bodies, but they also searched it for hubcaps, and none of those searches yielded any bodies.
On horseback?
Yeah. I mean, it's rural South Dakota. Yeah, he was a cool guy with a horse, looking for his hubcap. And presumably, if the shoe fell off of his horse, he would have gotten into his car and driven along the ditch and looked for the horseshoe.
It checks out.
You gotta have both to make sure you're covered for all situations. So that's why I should get a horse. And anyway, the man on horseback hadn't seen any bodies there at the time, and it wasn't as if the ditch had been a block of ice when he'd been there either. Quite the opposite, in fact. The weather had been decently warm at the time, and the ditch had been mostly dry and bare. And this is an important thing to note when it comes to the investigation. Yes, the water in the ditch had been frozen at the time of the car crash. And 3 months later, the ditch had contained several feet of water, which was the result of ice melting as spring moved in. But it wasn't as if the ditch had been full of ice and had gone directly from that to several feet of water. The ditch's contents had varied dependent on weather during the 3 months that Ruby and Arnold had been missing, and at times, the ditch had been virtually dry and empty. Also, I think that often when people imagine this case unfolding, they may think of the landscape as being heaped with snow. I've got to admit, that's kind of how I pictured it at first, knowing that it happened during winter in South Dakota. But when I looked up the historic weather records for the area via the Farmer's Almanac website, it painted a different, less precipitationally dramatic story. According to the Farmer's Almanac, no snow had been reported at all during the first half of December. At the time of the crash, some of the most recent measurable precipitation had occurred on December 6th. When 0.02 inches of rain or melted snow was recorded. Furthermore, on the day of the car crash, the temperature had actually peaked at 48 degrees Fahrenheit, or almost 9 degrees Celsius. And that wasn't some kind of anomaly. In the month of December in that area, temperatures routinely peaked in the 40s and upper 30s. The overall picture painted by the Farmer's Almanac for December of that year in that part of South Dakota is of relatively mild winter days that would allow the ice on the roads to melt, only to possibly refreeze as the sun set, ushering in colder nighttime temperatures. But there was no big downpour of snow. So apparently it wasn't the winter wonderland I had naively originally imagined, as someone who has never been to South Dakota. I bring this up because Unsolved.com, that's the official website for Unsolved Mysteries, allows users to publicly comment on their episode pages. And on the page for Ruby and Arnold's case, I stumbled upon a theory that someone posted in a comment, which I thought was a good example of thinking outside the box, actually. The commenter, who posted under the name Holmes, suggested that perhaps Ruby and Arnold had lain down in the icy ditch after the crash, and that the warmth of their bodies had caused the ice beneath them to melt, and they'd slip into the cold water beneath the ice layer and remain there until the arrival of spring caused the ice to melt 3 months later. They even noted that if the road had been salted, and I don't know if it was, to help drivers in winter driving conditions, the ditch might have contained a lot of salty runoff, which could perhaps have contributed to the ice melting more easily beneath the weight and warmth of Arnold and Ruby's bodies. And I don't know if it would. I didn't look it up, frankly, but it sounded intriguing. And like I said, I think this is a great example of thinking outside the box to develop a theory that perhaps hadn't already been considered, but after researching other sources outside of Unsolved Mysteries, namely older newspaper articles, there appears to be evidence that would rule out this theory, like the ditch drying up after the wreck and then refilling with ice melt later. Also, in order for the ice to melt and cave beneath the warmth of human bodies, I believe it would have to be a pretty thin layer of ice, probably thin enough that it would have broken under the weight of the adult human first. And according to Unsolved Mysteries, when the crash occurred, the car actually ended up in the ditch, and investigators noted that the ice beneath the car in the ditch was frozen solid. Another person, a woman who'd known Arnold, came forward and told investigators that she'd seen him alive and well and riding around in the company of three other people about 3 weeks after the crash on New Year's Eve. Investigators thought that the sighting seemed pretty credible. The woman hadn't just seen Arnold, she'd briefly spoken to him. And she knew him personally, so it wasn't as if she'd be likely to mistake anyone else for him. Investigators asked the woman to submit to a polygraph examination about the alleged sighting, and she agreed. She passed, too, for what it's worth, although we know that polygraph examinations aren't worth much, practically speaking, due to their notorious inaccuracy. The witness also gave investigators the names of a couple who she said had been in the car with Arnold when she'd run into them on New Year's Eve. So investigators spoke to that couple, and they refuted the witness's story, saying they hadn't been with Arnold at all. They didn't know what she was talking about. In fact, they claimed that they'd been home all night on New Year's Eve.
Did they submit to a polygraph and also come out as passing?
Well, they did submit to a polygraph examination, but they both failed, and I can't hold that against them because polygraph exams are kind of garbage.
Well, as you have memed in the past, they are hot garbage.
Yeah, so whether or not that witness really saw Arnold on New Year's Eve remains unknown. It seems that investigators found her claims pretty compelling, if not convincing, though. With the belief in mind that Arnold and Ruby had died at an unknown location and that the remains had later been moved to the ditch to be discovered, investigators struggled to imagine how they might have died and why. Had someone killed them or contributed to their deaths in some way? It was difficult to imagine why anyone might do so. In 1993, then-police captain Vincent Merrick told the Argus Leader newspaper the following, quote, "Both individuals were well-liked in the community. There had been no altercations, no fights or disputes with relatives or anyone else. Just doesn't add up," end quote. That same article also notes that at the time, investigators didn't suspect foul play because, well, there wasn't any evidence of it. Just a very perplexing situation that, as Captain Merrick said, didn't seem to add up. Later, the FBI assisted with the investigation. However, they eventually closed the case because they couldn't locate any evidence of foul play, and their expert involvement didn't yield any answers, which had to be a disappointment for Ruby and Arnold's loved ones, I'm sure. A special agent from the FBI's Sioux Falls field office summed up their involvement thusly. "All we know is that they appeared in the ditch, and that was it."
Okay, then.
That's what the FBI had to say. I don't know what else to tell you. Which raises the question, is it possible that Arnold and Ruby really did die accidentally somehow, say from exposure, And then someone stumbled across their bodies a couple months later and placed them in the ditch where they'd be more easily found by others?
Seems like a lot of risk to be caught with two dead bodies.
Yes.
And not to mention transporting decomposing bodies.
Yeah, there's a lot of holes in every theory, okay? But
there are few things in this world that I would look forward to doing less than transporting already decomposing bodies.
Presumably, a person's reasons for doing this thing would be to avoid contact with law enforcement and involvement with the investigation. Maybe they feared that being the ones to find Ruby and Arnold's bodies would cast suspicion their way. Or maybe they distrusted law enforcement or just didn't want the hassle of being involved in the investigation, and yet were willing to undergo the hassle of transporting deceased human remains. Now, my main problem with this theory, however, is that, like every other theory we've talked about, it doesn't seem to offer an explanation for why Ruby's body was so much more decomposed than Arnold's. If their bodies had been found near each other, with Ruby and Arnold having died of exposure, they should have been in similar states of decomposition. And this is one of those cases where every time you think you might have a sort of plausible, technically possible theory, you remember some strange facet of the case that seems to render it impossible. It can be frustrating just to contemplate, so I can only imagine how this case has frustrated investigators and Ruby and Arnold's loved ones especially. In 2011, nearly 20 years after Ruby and Arnold's deaths, former Charles Mix County Sheriff Ray Westendorf reflected on the case, calling it the most puzzling case of his entire 28-year career. He told the Mitchell Republic newspaper that he didn't believe that Ruby and Arnold had died of exposure or of car accident injuries, and he alluded to the possibility of foul play, although he admitted that, quote, "It's pretty hard to prove somebody was murdered when you don't have any evidence to prove it." End quote.
The only evidence I can see towards murder would be the different states of decomposition, and I'm sure there's a way to explain it, though not being an expert in body decomposition, I don't know.
Well, I think there's more to it than that. Yes, that's very perplexing, but also, Arnold and Ruby, according to all the experts who've investigated the case, did not die in that ditch. They were moved there later, and dead people don't move their own remains post-mortem. So somebody moved their remains. And if they did that, why? It seems to imply that they may have been involved in their deaths somehow and didn't want to be implicated. Almost all of the questions that baffled investigators 30 years ago remain unanswered now. Questions like, where did Ruby and Arnold actually die, and when? Why had Ruby's remains undergone so much more decomposition than Arnold's? Was it because she had died sooner?
What about the keys?
Who placed their bodies in the ditch where they were ultimately discovered, and why? Were they involved in their deaths? And what about those mysterious keys in Arnold's pocket? Explain that one with the lake, Scott. Investigators were never able to find the doors or vehicle that they went to. Where Arnold acquired those keys and what they were meant to unlock remains a mystery. These questions have gone unanswered for far too long, and one thing is for sure. If Ruby and Arnold died elsewhere and were later placed in the ditch, as law enforcement has repeatedly stated they believe was the case, someone knows how they got there, and perhaps they know a lot more than that. If you have any information about the deaths of Arnold Archambeau or Ruby Bruyere, please call the Charles Mix County Sheriff's Office at 605-487-7625.
That's all for this episode of Last Seen Alive. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Make sure you check out our website, lastseenalivepodcast.com, for photos from the story and links to the sources we use to write it. While you're at it, follow us on Insta and Twitter at LSA Podcast. New episodes of Last Seen Alive go live every other Monday. See you then. And if you think bringing unsolved cases like Ruby and Arnold's to the public's attention is important, please take a moment to rate or review Last Seen Alive and tell your friends to check us out too. We'd really appreciate it. Last Seen Alive is written and researched by you, Leah. Audio engineering and editing is provided by me, Scott, along with our podcast production partners, Podcast Post Production. Check them out at podcastpostproduction.com for all of your podcasting needs.